thanks for watching. It's called the Eigen Bros Podcast. You better watch next week. Seriously. Actually watch, because I'm going to watch from now on, and I'll find out how many of you aren't watching. And go to eigenbros.com. No one's telling me to say this off screen. It's coming from my heart. E-A-Y-O.
We should just start it right now.
I know, yeah. Okay, 3, 2, 1.
All right.
Hello, here ladies and gentlemen.
We're being serenaded by
Gabe. Jesus.
Optarina. Honestly, though, it's pretty good.
I love it, man. Yeah, you speak Russian?
I don't speak Russian, no. But I'm learning. I have Duolingo.
Oh, ooh. Hell yeah.
And I ignore its notifications.
Yeah.
Yeah. It gets so passive aggressive sometimes. Yeah, yeah. Right?
Pull it out when if a conversation starter. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm also learning Russian. Let me just look at this, Baba Yaga or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, level 3.
Sek Bliat. Yeah. What's the one that
Suka
they
always say? Suka Bliat. I think that means.
Rev up those fryers.
Yeah, yeah, something like that.
Suck my, I'm not gonna say.
I thought it meant hello from all the years of people on Counter-Strike saying that to me.
Yeah, yeah. It means
I was
something.
Like, hey, hello to you too.
It means something. Bleat this
fryers.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, yeah. So, guys, we have a guest today here.
Yeah.
Gabe, he's a fellow researcher, physicist, and we wanted to talk to him a little bit today about some research. So.
Yeah,
let's get to it. Let's just jump in, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, last night I had a really good research day.
Oh yeah.
Oh dang.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
And it consisted of me not doing any work the entire day, and then reading very intensely for like 4 hours, and then going home and smoking a bowl, playing music for 2 hours, and then writing an hour before I went to sleep. And in that 1 hour of writing, I was able to like condense that whole, the last 2 weeks of thought into like a good solid 3 paragraphs.
Yeah.
And then the, I guess the essence of what I was really writing last night was something called the information structure. That this is kind of the I would say the best name I have for what I think I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it starts from, I named it an information structure because it's fundamentally related to something called a dissipative structure. And a dissipative structure is something that was created by some guy named Ilya Prigozhin. I think he did it in like the 70s or 80s. And
Russian, typical.
Yeah, I think he was from, Brussels.
Yeah,
I don't know where that is.
There's a school in Brussels where he did most of his work, and then he went to University of Texas, Austin.
Cool.
He started school there. And so he did this. He won his Nobel Prize, actually, for dissipative structures.
Oh,
he was a chemist. But the idea was that he was studying these chemical reactions, and there's one called that they invented called the Brucellator. And
hell yeah.
From the school of Brussels. And his whole driving force behind the work that he did was to really understand what is the nature of irreversibility in time. And all of this
work, irreversible nature of time.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Just clarifying.
Yeah. And all of this work done by him was kind of started in right around the same time quantum was coming out, like 30s and 40s and things like that. And he decided to just take a completely different route from most of the physicists at the time, and he wanted to go into the notion of time. And he focused most of his efforts into thermodynamics, non-equilibrium thermodynamics, and equilibrium thermodynamics. And it's because he understood that time had a very special role in this particular field, and that was related to the role of entropy. It seemed to have a preferred direction, right, which was identified by entropy. And so this was a starting point for a lot of the work he did, and he developed a large framework for this, and it led him to get his Nobel Prize in dissipative structures, which are processes that happen out of equilibrium. And you can think of equilibrium as having a few properties, where one of the main properties is time reversal symmetry.
And keep that mic close to you.
Yeah, time reversal symmetry. And in equilibrium, all of these tiny macroscopic processes, they're time reversal. If you just flip the momentum, you reverse the laws of physics, everything is invariant under it, right? But these, when you have things happen outside of equilibrium, you break time reversal symmetry. And dissipative structures are processes. They're not just, it's a type of non-equilibrium steady state. And by that, we mean it's something, it's kind of like an object that is able to maintain itself outside of equilibrium by dissipating a certain amount of energy. So it, the second, you can think of equilibrium as being an attractor state. When you move something out of equilibrium, like pull a one of those sticky hands, it takes work to move something out of equilibrium. You're going to want to go back. The state's going to want to go back into equilibrium. Well, the further you are from equilibrium, the more work it takes to maintain a state out of equilibrium. But there are certain reactions or processes that, happen out of equilibrium that happen in such a way that they can maintain themselves, they can sustain themselves. And what is being sustained is this type of structure. And by structure, we mean a particular combination of processes, some transfer of energy that happens in like a cycle, a chemical reaction that's oscillating. That's like the famous one, the oscillating chemical reactions. And it's called the Bruciolator. And it's just the number of...
So it's a thing that people see in chemistry?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, because I've never heard of it. Yeah. You know, we're physicists of, you know, at least third year graduate.
Yeah.
I never heard of a Bruciolator.
Oh, yeah.
Well, me,
Yeah, Bruciolator sounds like a cool, like,
it sounds cool,
name.
Yeah.
I
mean, just if we...
He's a big-ass guy, too, you know.
I am the Bruciolator.
If we type in, like, I'm going to Google search oscillating chemical reactions.
Yeah.
And there's, like, this one. It's called the Belousov-Zabotinsky reaction.
Okay.
Ooh, that looks
so
cool.
So it looks very psychedelic, right? Yeah. It's very appealing to the eye, and it just looks like that. And it's these reactions that... These things happen out of equilibrium, and it's something where it happens in a cyclic or oscillatory nature, and the products that it produces, that's redundant, but the products of this reaction are then used as the reactants, and the cycle continues, and so it always produces what it needs to consume, and it maintains itself.
So I imagine, though, you need something to, like, catalyze or trigger this kind of reaction.
Yes.
What's the process in order to get this thing even started?
The process is generally, well, there's,
or just
there's,
like a general system.
This is general system.
Okay.
There's a class of chemical, systems that act in this way. And the reason they're being studied is because they were used as models. Actually the first one to really study this was a few people, but it was first mentioned in an article called What is Life by Erwin Schrödinger. He wrote about this and the concept of negative entropy, and how metabolism is a type of way to sustain a system out of equilibrium. You take food in very low entropy forms like apples and beef, and you break them apart. And by doing that, you can maintain a structure of the human body and the symbiosis between all the organs and stuff like that. And Alan Turing, he did something called the study of morphogenesis. And he studied how you can have... the cells, the membrane of a cell, you can have oscillating chemical reactions around the ring of a cell. And he saw that this behavior had some emergent properties that were unexpected. And but these are a general class of systems. Typically, what is needed for these things to be called dissipative structures is they need to satisfy certain properties. They need to produce... They need to follow some equation of entropy production. They need to have a, and they need to be unstable, in a sense. There's some instability that needs to happen.
Can you give us like any concrete examples of what a particular system in real life is that would follow this kind of mathematics?
Yeah, so
like any simple one you can think of, you know.
So this, the brucellator, is probably the simplest in terms of chemical equations.
No, but I mean, like, do you know of any, like, real-life system? Like,
what well, this the brucellator... is real. This is real life.
Yeah, but that's got to be... That's the mathematics that gets put onto a particular system,
well,
he
right? just gave the example... If I read this correctly, you were saying, like, there was the example of the cell, the outer membrane kind of has these kind of reactions happening.
Yeah, so...
Right?
Okay,
oh, I see. Okay, okay.
So
yeah,
these
yeah.
type of... these types of reactions can also be seen in, I think, a lot of biological systems.
I can imagine.
Something called chemical clocks. So, you know, the human body has a type of circadian rhythm, right? And so why, you know, what allows the mind to almost like subconsciously know what time it is? And I have not done research in this, so I'm just simply speculating here.
Yeah.
But I believe it may or may not be tied to some type of oscillating chemical reaction where there could be some very stable and consistent oscillating chemical reaction in the human body, and say that it takes, let's say, 5 milliseconds for this reaction to finish. And what it does is it starts, it's like a gradient reaction. We just mm-hmm. say there's a concentration of chemical over here, and it pushes potassium over here, and then it goes back, and then that takes a certain amount of time. And then there's another reaction, some other chemical process or exchange of energy or thermodynamic something cycle that says, okay, well, the catalyst that I need to start is 3 of these small chemical oscillations. So when this thing happens 3 times, that's when I start. And then this thing maybe takes its own cycle. And then you have this hierarchy of chemical reactions or thermodynamic cycles of exchanges of processes or kinetic compounds or whatever, and they build up into you having these you know, rhythms,
like
cycles of time,
yeah,
in your body.
Systems, yeah.
So these kind of cycles here are actually like periodic cycles. They're not like these chaotic systems.
So you can chaos is misunderstood.
Yeah.
First
okay.
of all,
okay.
Because you can have chaos in periodic systems. So one of the simplest examples is something called the, and I just learned about this a few months ago, it's called the Baker's Map. And it's called the Baker's Map because it...
blaze it, dude.
Exactly. it looks like the kneading of dough. So what you do is you start off with a space, and it's the unit square. So you have 0, 1, X, and 0, 1 on Y. And what you do is you just partition your space into two, just imagine putting a line down the middle of like a square, and one's black, one's white. And what you do is for every point in this phase space, you multiply the X by 2, and you multiply the Y by Y minus 1 over 2. So you stretch the X, and then you compress the Y, and you put it back on top of each other. And
you're losing me.
It's hard to visualize.
What is it called?
It's
so
called
I can maybe
the
put it on the podcast.
Baker's Map. Yeah,
Baker's Map.
You know, it's a good idea. I can probably like send you guys links to put up.
Yeah, for sure.
I could probably even Google if it's real easy to find. You know.
Yeah, I'm gonna put it. I'm gonna Google it right now. Actually.
Okay.
Well, I'm a very visual person, so for me,
yeah.
I have to have like examples.
Yeah. The example of like, well, like biological systems, right? Mm-hmm. I think the argument is that the overall, like, because you have to overall increase entropy, right?
Yeah, always increasing.
Yeah.
So here's an example of a Baker's Map. So as you can see, what'll happen is it'll reset in a moment.
Oh, is that why you're saying it looks like kneading dough?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You would cut
it
in half,
what the hell
and stretch it, cut it in half and stretch it. So it starts off with 2 halves, red and blue, and then you just keep doing that, and it keeps getting finer and finer partitions.
And they mix, or what is going on?
It's a way of mixing. It's a way of taking a state that's initially red and blue, like that. And notice, it repeats, and then you have... What'll happen is this eventually gets evenly distributed. And now you lose the order in your system. You started off with an ordered system of just red and blue.
Right.
And by repeated applications of the Baker's Map, you've essentially mixed all your points. You've mixed all the red and all the blue together.
So this would be an example of saying, like, you can get order or you can get some chaos from an ordered operation or something.
Yes, and this is a dynamical transformation. It's used in dynamic systems theory, and it's measure preserving, which means that the area or the volume of the space that you're working with is preserved under this transformation. So that's important in the context when you're applying this to talking about real physical systems, like dilute gases, which is kind of what I'm working with, because you need to, when you want to study this on phase space, you want phase space to be conserved per Liouville's theorem. And so, having this in and of itself is not a Hamiltonian evolution. It's just has really unique properties and is characteristic of chaos. The mixing that you see here, where you have two well-defined partitions, and after iterating this dynamic transformation or this operation many times, those two partitions become mixed. That is what Gibbs talked about in his idea of Gibbs mixing as one of the conditions required to have entropy.
So how does this tie back into the whole information, what'd you call it, besides you said dissipative?
Oh, information structure.
Yeah, the information structure. How does that fit into your information structures regime? But I guess, actually, let me just to clarify for the audience, I guess. So Gabe is trying to come up with his own type of theoretical framework to explain time, is it? Or what was it to explain
exactly?
Yeah,
so I'm essentially, I've really taking a lot of at this point this is all independent work. I have not been doing this with an advisor or anyone, essentially. I've been
doing passion project.
Exactly. My own work for the past couple years, and a very large guidance of my work has been the work of Prigogine. And I feel like his work has been largely kind of unnoticed.
Can you say his name again?
Yeah, so his name is Ilya. I think it's Ilya.
Yeah.
Prigogine. Prigogine.
Okay, okay.
And his work is phenomenal. And as of the past decade or so, there's been these things, maybe 20 years actually, it could be a little skin, losing track of what year it is, but.
the quarantine does that, bro. Yeah.
There's been this surge of interest in these things called molecular motors. And these molecular motors are what people are calling information engines. And this all really started with something called the Crookes fluctuation theorem and the Jarzynski inequality, which were two theorems about non-equilibrium work and fluctuations and how they related to equilibrium. And these particular fluctuation theorems and equalities or inequalities, they're valid arbitrarily far away from equilibrium. And so this was something that we didn't have access to before. And people use those to start studying molecules and, you know, these little chemical motors and things like that. And that started this huge study of thermodynamics of information. It kind of really picked up in the past few years. There's a review article by Parondo, Hasewaga, and a few others that it's called The Thermodynamics of Information. It's on Nature. I think it came out 2012, 2014.
Right,
and,
right.
And they review all of this stuff. And so they talk about the current state of really what information is. They give examples of why it's something more physical than what we normally expect it to be. It's not just entropy. It's really not.
Entropy is like an oversimplification of something that has more.
It's entropy in a very particular case.
Yeah. Information is?
Information is equal to Shannon's entropy or whatever, or the thermodynamic entropy. So
now, can I just stop you there for real quick, just to touch on this? So we kind of were talking about this. We talked about this conversation. It all was prompted by a bar conversation we had, we discussed Shannon's paper. So I was familiar with Shannon's paper when I was working in the fiber optic industry, and I was like, wow, this is some, you know, genius paper.
Yeah.
And it kind of describes like information in a very generalized framework. But I don't remember him invoking entropy in it. Did he actually invoke, was he the first guy to invoke like entropy equations into that?
He was the first. He derived an expression for information entropy.
Okay. And so it was related to that.
Yes.
Was that the start of that?
It was a way to quantify the amount of disorder in a message.
I see. Right? I see.
In disorder in communication channels. Because there was always, he talked about transferring information from one thing, or transferring a message from one location to another, and it goes, passes through a channel, and there's some loss. And the loss is a source of uncertainty. The noise is a source of uncertainty. And therefore, all of this is done with probabilities and conditional stuff. And if you work with probability theory, you can derive inequalities and equalities from the conditional probabilities before and after the probability of variable X and Y. And out of this, you build this, it's like a Bayesian framework, and you build a information theory from all of this. And it happens that the expression that he derived for that quantifies the disorder caused by the noise in the channel took the same form as Boltzmann's entropy.
I think I formula. Do vaguely remember this.
And it's the only thing they it's the entropy is equal to P ln of P. And they differ by a fundamental constant, which is Boltzmann's constant, right?
KBT see. Or okay. whatever.
So they're one of them is unitless. The information one is unitless. But these
and
two
P would be what? The probability?
The probability. Okay. Yeah. The probability of yeah. These two quantities are equal in equilibrium, but to this day, I do not believe there is a general consensus in the scientific community, at least, on whether or not there is a rigorously defined non-equilibrium entropy, especially microscopically. Right. So, like,
can we unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So.
A non-rigorously defined.
We understand entropy as in the context of equilibrium. I mean, by definition, equilibrium is the maximum entropy. So it's easy to find a function. The properties of entropy are it has to have a monotonic increase to a maximum under the time evolution of your Hamiltonian or of your energy or whatever.
Okay.
So what happens is if a function and it's concave, or I believe it's convex.
What's con? What
it's
is?
The one where if you have a function and you draw a line between two of it, there's always going to be a part that's going to be
under it.
Under it, yeah.
What are you describing though?
I'm describing the form of the form entropy. Of the entropy
yeah. Oh, the form of the entropy.
The form of the entropy. Yeah.
It would look to me. It seems like it looked like a logarithm or something, right?
Yes.
Or is that wrong?
I mean, it does, and it has like it looks like a.
But the line would keep going off.
Yeah.
To. It would never go concave though, right? Because it's not going to fall back down. The entropy is not going
to
go down.
You're saying it looks like half that or something.
Yeah.
He's just trying to say.
Oh, okay. Okay.
He's trying to describe the graph.
Okay, you're trying to remember if it's concave or concave.
Yeah, yeah.
I forget, I don't remember.
He's trying to describe the graph.
Curve.
Anyway,
down. I don't know.
It has these really specific properties, and these are well defined in equilibrium. Okay. But the problem is in non-equilibrium, this gets very tricky because the problem with, as far as I understand it, the problem with non-equilibrium thermodynamics or statistical mechanics is that you don't have a reference state. Equilibrium is a state of reference. And what it does is it provides you with initial conditions and with symmetries. And with those two things, you essentially can solve many, many problems. But when you're working with non-equilibrium systems, in order to even obtain any sensible result from your thing, you almost have to assume that whatever system you're studying is connected back to an equilibrium system and then left to equilibrate.
So what's wrong with that?
Left to relax at some time scale. And then only in the relaxation of this state do you understand its non-equilibrium properties. Let's say that it takes, you can imagine that the further a system is from equilibrium, the longer it's going to take to relax to equilibrium. The more work it's going to dissipate when relaxing. So we can understand how far something is from equilibrium, the distance it is, and how much work it took to get there by connecting this system, by we begin at an equilibrium system, let's say equilibrium point A, we perturb the system out of equilibrium by some parametric process, you know, and then we connect, and right now we're not studying it, we're just perturbing it out of equilibrium, and then we connect the system back to a heat bath at equilibrium and let it relax. And it's in the only after it relaxes to equilibrium, it's in the relaxation process that we can obtain this information about its non-equilibrium state.
And so why is that an issue?
It's an issue because we don't know how to, again, this is, I don't want to speak in, I don't know, this is just me, this is the little
your,
that
your
I do
inference.
Know. Yeah,
yeah,
my inference is that, like, I don't believe we know how to really study a non-equilibrium system without referencing to equilibrium.
But then my question is, how come that is a problem? Because I could always see the state where you're like, okay, I have a non-equilibrium system, but if I know of the, let's say, the system that's attached to that, that's feeding it that perturbation or something, then you just include that piece, like you were saying, into the system, and then you're fine, right?
I believe the problem is that it's restrictive. I mean, most of life, or most of the things that we encounter are non-equilibrium. Actually, everything, as far as I know, everything is non-equilibrium. Equilibrium is a sense of, it's a lot of people have called it the state of death. It's the state of everything has reached saturation. There is no time. The concept of time doesn't exist in equilibrium. It's completely reversible. It's just a point of just of absence of movement. And so, as far as I'm concerned, life is non-equilibrium. Every chemical thing that happens, every biological process, every even, you know, spontaneous decay and radiation, these are non-equilibrium processes. So there is, to have a consistent and, to have a consistent framework that allows us to study things without having to reference essentially a point of ideology. This is really, like, you know, ideal state of equilibrium would be greatly beneficial to helping us understand what's really happening.
Interesting. So then, is your research, though, you reference Ilya
Prigozhin.
Is he directly working on something similar to, or similar to what you're pursuing? Are you trying to extend his work? Are you branching away from it?
So his work, again, I mean, I have so much respect for that man, and I don't think he's gotten the credit he deserves. I mean, he won a Nobel Prize, but in particular,
well, the work, how much more credit do you want him to get, Gabe?
I mean,
$1 million.
I mean, I think he's one of the. I see him as one of the greats. His understanding of time, and especially in non-equilibrium systems, I put him up there with, like, Dirac and Feynman and Heisenberg.
What was his Nobel for?
Dissipative structures.
Okay.
And he has, I mean, he has these books about him. And I think the last book he wrote was in 2003. I think he shortly passed after. And it's called Is Future Given? And it's funny because I was reading this book the other day, and I wrote on my hand, Is Future Given? I wrote it on the top of my hand, the back here, and then also on the palm. And I wrote it because I needed to remind myself to look at this book before I went to sleep. Like, okay. And then as I went on through the day, I became aware of the fact that the writing on the palm of my hand was a lot more worn than the one on the back of my hand. And I thought of this, it's funny because I thought of that as, of course, when you're crazy like I am, everything relates to your research. So this was an example of my research, because I saw my hand as a binary system, 0, 1, right? Okay. And it, the way I thought about it was that the writing on the palm of my hand is more worn because it's more work. The bottom of my hand sees more work than the top of my hand. Okay. It gets sampled more often. It touches more of the things. So I saw that as, like, as work, as, like, being sampled or being measured. It's like the more you measure, it could be the same information, but if one of it is measured more than the other one, then that information is going to be lost. Because at the end of the day, the information that was at the palm of my hand was gone. The only one that was left was the one that was not sampled as much.
Yeah.
And so it's something about, if you have, let's say, a state of information, or and that's in it that it's confusing. Like, what do you mean by state of information? But just something like, as silly as this example, you have my hand being a state of information. The one that's sampled more often or does more work,
yeah,
the information is going to be lost. It's not going to be, you won't be able to make any predictable predictions about the future to it. It's just the information is not passed on.
Right.
So did you get to read the book, or did you get to look at it? What
yeah, I was reading it earlier in the day, and I wrote down some stuff I wanted to bring, but I just didn't have time.
No, you're good.
But it was, he really talked about how he began to see information as kind of a flow of correlations. And he started this work in, like, kinetic theory. He started working with, like, harmonic oscillators on a lattice. Mm-hmm. And he saw that irreversibility was connected to the flow of correlations. So as particles collided, what happened was you formed correlations between these particles, and they became more random.
Mm-hmm.
And the process became more irreversible. So there was a way to talk about irreversibility in terms of, as time evolved, how were the correlations increasing or decreasing?
Mm.
So
irreversibility as a function of correlation.
Yeah. This was his work that he did, I believe, very early on in his career. But it's laid the idea that there was a connection between the irreversible nature of time and correlations among particles.
Mm. And when
coming from interactions.
Yeah, when physicists talk about correlations, I guess maybe we should define that a little
sure,
bit.
Sure. Just the correlation, meaning that there's an interaction with something else. Something's correlated with another thing in terms of now it's related to another object.
Yeah, they can interact through some potential, or there's a coupling term between the two, what correlation function in a magnet, right?
Sure.
Yeah,
it's a very general thing.
It is a very general thing. You know, if you're imagining what a correlation is, you're probably on the right track.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting, man. I like what you're trying to do here. But is there any other things you can tell us maybe about where you're at in terms of development of the information
structure?
Structures.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So I see an information structure as having some like dual nature. The way that I see it is it's a structure that represents the interaction of a microscopic system with a macroscopic object. And this could be a measurement device or someone
what kind of measurement?
Any sort of measurement. So in particular, what I'm having in mind is this Sillard engine, which is a variant of the Maxwell's demon. So for those people that are not familiar with this, the Maxwell's demon is a thought experiment, which I believe was one of the first times information was really thought about in a physical sense.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was the fact that if you have a box full of particles in equilibrium, so they're at some constant temperature, right? And it has maximum entropy because it's at equilibrium. A very, I think he said, nifty fingered demon, in the words of Maxwell himself, something like that, could insert a barrier in the middle of the box, and through repeated measurements of the velocities of the particles, could separate the slow moving ones into one side and then the fast moving ones to the other side, and in this way can reduce the entropy of the system. And that went against the second law of thermodynamics. And, you know, this was a paradox for quite some time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think it was Leo Szilard, the same person who worked on the Manhattan Project. I didn't know that until I watched a documentary on the Manhattan Project recently. It's really good. Side note, have you guys seen the show Chernobyl?
No,
no,
not yet.
I heard
it's
good.
It's been heavily recommended.
Yes, yeah. Watch it. I wish there was a show like that about the Manhattan Project.
That honestly, it's sorely needed, I think, because like I read books,
something
mostly
that
around
has
it.
Very accurate scientific background, but also has that like political drama and like weight of the era to it. And I would love
to cool
see
that would be
and so
like
cool.
to see a young Feynman too. I don't think he's ever been portrayed.
Oppenheimer,
on film.
Feynman, like Szilard, like
that'd be
Einstein
badass.
Was
von
there
Neumann,
too.
Einstein, dude.
No, Einstein was not on the Manhattan Project. He
was
wrote
around.
The letter He was, but he wrote the letter to get it started.
He urged the president. Yeah.
But imagine him making a cameo. Like,
that'd be cool, too.
Just like a crazy haired guy. Just
that'd be badass, man.
That's the golden age of physics.
Like, yeah,
yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to what I was saying. Leo Szilard proposed a variant of the Maxwell's demon where instead of you still have a box of some volume, right, at some temperature. But instead of many particles, you have a single particle. And so what you do is the demon could be anything. And this is where, like, recently people have found out that the demon doesn't have to be a person. It can be a completely mechanical device. In fact, we have autonomous Maxwell's demons. They're called information engines, and they work without an observer. They work they're self-contained.
Yeah, and I imagine cells are sort of like
and this ties back to Turing's work of chemical oscillating reactions. Yeah. And autonomous Maxwell's demon I see as a type of information structure. It's something that can maintain itself out of equilibrium, and it does so by dissipating entropy, and it maintains a minimum amount of information. So information, I see it as a structure. So, like, going back to the Szilard engine, so what you do is you have a single particle of gas in a box. You insert the piston right down the middle. And what you're doing is you're trapping the particle on either the left side or the right side of the box, right? And when you do that, you need to record what side the particle is on. The demon or the device, whatever, the memory bank, if you're talking really arbitrary here, just needs to know what side the particle is on. And this is a really important detail, as we shall see in a little bit. Because now what you have to do to extract work from this device, and this was the purpose of the device, was to try and harness thermal fluctuations. So you then connect a piston to the side where the particle is on.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is, because this is a single particle of gas, the other side of the box that does not contain the particle is vacuum. And so the pressure, even though it's only pressure from one particle of gas, it's still enough for you to move the piston. So that gas is going to push the piston, and that piston can be connected to some engine, right? That's how pistons work. This gas expands, so you just connect this to an engine, and you're able to move. You know, you can move a molecule. You could move. You could start a chemical reaction by moving breaking a bond, or just something that requires very little work to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was, you let the particle then push the piston all the way to one side. The piston is removed, and you can reinsert the barrier again. And you were supposed to repeat this process many, many times, and extract every time KB ln of 2 of energy from this system.
Okay.
And he was like, this is how we can do this. You know, we can beat the second law. And what was later found out by Bennett and Landauer, who I think Bennett worked at IBM, and he worked on a paper. This is a great paper called The Thermodynamics of Computation. And Landauer gave this famous phrase called information is physical. And what they both came to understand, there's something called Landauer's principle. And Landauer's principle was that, okay, the cost of, there is an energetic cost to this whole process. It's not free energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the energetic cost is hidden. It's not necessarily, in what I just described, you would think, oh, we are getting free energy. As long as we have infinite amount of memory, we can just keep doing this, right? But the energetic cost comes in the resetting of the device.
Right.
Yeah.
When you reset the device, you have to remember that we've recorded which side it was on. If we still have that information available to us, we're not going to know where it is the next time. So we have to erase the previous measurement. When you erase the measurement, there is you shrink the phase space, and so that takes energy to shrink the phase space of your system. You like if you imagine the state of the demon and the particle location as like a little six-sided box where you have memory, location, and then the six different spots. He knows where it's at in the left. He doesn't know where it's at in the left. He knows where it's at in the right. He doesn't know where it's at in the right. Mm-hmm. Or he doesn't know where either of them are.
Yeah.
That corresponds to shrinking phase space, and that takes KB ln of 2 of energy. So
interesting.
There is no free energy, but the entropy can be reduced. Mm. So you can reduce the entropy of the system in a Maxwell's demon, but it's you cannot extract free energy from it. And so he tied the energetic cost to the erasing of information, not necessarily the writing down of information. So
this is what the Szilard engine.
So this is what Landauer found while studying the Szilard engine.
I see. And this is a similar problem to the Maxwell's demon, which has the same result, correct?
Exactly, okay. Yeah. And so the I see the Szilard engine as a type of it can be seen as a thermodynamic process. I see it as a dynamic transformation. Because it's cyclic. You insert the piston, mm-hmm. you measure the location, you move the piston to the side, you extract the piston, you erase your memory, and you do it again. And so you can repeat this over and over again. Mm-hmm. There was a recent paper, may not be so recent.
Why does that make it cyclic? Just because you can repeat it doesn't mean it's going to.
They've done it where you can build a Szilard engine type device that has these parameters. They model a Szilard engine, and they find that for this thing can reach a steady state. So it'll just keep operating. For certain conditions, it'll just keep doing this on its own. Mm-hmm. You don't have to put in, as long as like
that you, almost sounds like free energy.
It's not.
But it could go on indefinitely.
It will keep repeating this process. And the process, I mean...
Well, I guess it's not free energy because then you can't convert it to anything.
So...
But you can have something that periodically goes forever?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's...
Interesting. Do we know any simple
systems?
These
oscillating chemical reactions do that. They maintain themselves out of equilibrium because the products that they produce are the reactants they need, and then they just keep doing that. They always produce more than what they need to react, and so they keep reacting.
Do we know anything of like that
in
real life?
I mean, that's how bombs work. The cascade process. You have...
You mean like atomic bombs?
Yeah.
No, but the problem is with atomic bombs, eventually...
The atomic bombs are not cyclic because they cascade, but the concept is similar in the sense that it keeps going.
Yeah, but it only keeps going with however many atoms that you can actually break the bonds of. So it does have a limit. It's limited by the number of atoms within that bomb. In this system, you're saying, though, it can just keep moving and moving and moving and moving and moving continuously.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps...
Indefinitely.
There's... The
Szilard
engine
true.
Is not so. It's not so good of an example to think about like a perpetual mobile device.
Yeah.
In terms of the Szilard engine, because it's not really that.
Because that's what it is. Perpetual motion machine should not be possible, and that sounds like a perpetual motion machine.
And it's not because it is restricted, definitely.
Okay, but so what is the restriction then? Is it just from normal energy dissipation
from
like heat or something?
It actually comes from the amount of information that can be written during an interaction.
Oh, so that decreases over time.
It will, if in the, I'm thinking of a particular model, and called, it's a three-state system. It's like ABC, and it's just like a clock. You have three faces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this thing coupled to a bit, which is 0, 1. So it's ABC in a clock mm-hmm. plus a 0 and a 1. And they form a six-state system. You have A0, B0, C0,
okay.
A1, B1, C1.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is this demon can go, or this device, it can mm-hmm. go ABC, CBA, ABBA. It can transfer between any state ABC in the zero part. And it can transfer between any state A1, B1, C1, in the one part. But if it wants to go C0 to A1, if you want to go from a 0 to a 1, you need to involve the flipping of the bit. So
okay.
You can think of it as a two-level system. here we have ABC and
sure.
they're all zeros, and here we have ABC and they're all zeros.
Mm-hmm.
And we can move along this line of ABC as much as we want for free. And we can move along this line of ABC as much as we want for free mm-hmm. up here. But if we want to go from something down here mm-hmm. to something up here, it requires us to flip the bit.
And that requires energy is what you're saying.
Yeah, that requires okay. some sort of energy. And so it's limited. You can quantify that by having differences in entropy. And the amount of energy that's required is related to the amount of entropy that can be written down and so on and so forth and the rate at which they interact. So there are parameters that limit this from being a perpetual mobile device.
But let's say you just want to stay within the horizontal regime of ABC and the zero part. Can you just indefinitely move between A, B, and C in that regime?
Yes, you could, but in the particular device that I'm talking about, a flipping of 0 to 1 is what causes the device to do work, to lift the mouse.
Okay, so there is no device then if you're not actually doing the bit flip. It's not the same device. Then.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the point. Okay. So what you just said is the main point of all of these recent literatures and study into this stuff is that mm-hmm. The second law can be. We've now reached a point where we can generalize the second law. We can reduce the entropy of a system in a cyclic process. We can beat the second law of thermodynamics as long as we write information down. So we can do work in a cyclic thermodynamic process. I think it was the Carnot statement that says no thermodynamic cycle can be more efficient than the Carnot cycle. Mm-hmm. Like, and we can be more efficient than the Carnot cycle, but we have to write information down. So information can be seen as a thermodynamic resource, just like heat. It's something that allows us to do work, but we can do all of this work fine. We have to write information down. But if we need, when it comes time to erase that information, we need to be remind ourselves that, okay, that's going to take work. The work that we gained from writing all of this information down, we're going to have to put back into erasing it. So
information exchange is like a more general important property.
It's very general. It really has to do with how thermodynamic systems exchange energy and produce entropy and what allows them to essentially transform from one thermodynamic state into another, and the allowed transitions in these thermodynamic processes we are now realizing are there's a lot more allowed transitions that we didn't expect because we never took into account information as being part of these physical processes There's things now called information reservoirs. Just like you have a heat bath where when you do any sort of exchange, you pull from the heat bath or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's things called information baths. And they're just these massive reservoirs of information.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been modeled as a Turing strip, like a blank tape mm-hmm. with all zeros or all ones or a mix of zeros and ones. Mm-hmm. And these are what scientists are now using as information baths, information reservoirs that you write. So if you just imagine a very long strip of all zeros, right? Like a Turing strip of all zeros,
okay.
Turing tape. And then one particular zero here, this is a zero that interacts with our device. And then after the interaction, it interacts one bit at a time. And what comes out is a mix of zeros and ones. Mm-hmm. So every one of these bits can have equal probability of being a zero or a one, and we make the choice to make the incoming bit all zeros. We're initializing the memory. We're imposing an initial condition, and this is also important. And when it interacts with the daemon, what comes out is a mix of zeros and ones, and you can calculate the entropy of the incoming bit stream, and it's going to be zero, very low, because they're all the same, and then the entropy for the outcoming bit stream, which is going to be higher. There is a mix of zeros and ones. And by doing that, by increasing the entropy of this information that is coming into the device and going out of the device, you're allowed to lift a mass. You're allowed to do work. So this is an easy conceptual example of how information can be used as a work source.
That's interesting. I remember we discussed that at the bar
yeah.
at the time, and I was kind of mind blown because I was like, that sounds interesting, but I don't quite get what that means. And I got to say, I still don't quite get what that means.
It's okay. Neither do I really.
But I would love to see some more like resources on that. Do you have any people you could shout out? Or do you remember the names of the authors who wrote some of these things so that
the
audience could check them out?
One of the authors is Christopher Jarzynski. He's at right now at the University of College Park, Maryland, I believe, doing great work up there.
What's one of the big papers?
He was one of the big names in the field of non-equilibrium stuff because he has his own inequality, the Jarzynski inequality, which is
nice.
It's a way to calculate the work done in a non-equilibrium process moving between two equilibrium states. So it's kind of what I discussed earlier. If we have an equilibrium state A and we, through some parametric process, perturb it, so we move it, we kick it out of equilibrium and it goes along some path in non-equilibrium and then we connect it back to equilibrium, well, those two equilibrium states, A and B, they're going to have a free energy difference, the free energy of A, the free energy of B.
Right.
Those differences, they give us the average work done along the process from one state to the other.
Sure.
And it's given by some, like, I think it's the exponential average. It's like the average of E to the minus beta W is equal to the delta F or something like that. I may be wrong. LN delta F.
Sure.
Anyway, there's some inequality that he gives. And so, yeah, he started this. That was a big step in the right direction. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
So he's at UM College Park.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, I think he contributed to the model I was talking about. It's called an exactly solvable model of information processing in a Maxwell's daemon. And that's the one with the three-state system. And so there's all this work happening in that sense. But then there's this really fundamental framework of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics that Prigozhin started in all of his work. And I'm noticing that there's a way to connect these two.
Yeah.
Prigozhin talks about operators. He talks about extending classical mechanics. He talks about extending quantum mechanics. And when he does this, he includes a microscopic entropy operator, which it doesn't seem possible because there's something called Poincaré's theorem, which states that you cannot have a function on your phase space that is monotonically increasing to a maximum. And this function cannot even be multiplied by a phase factor. So that's just essentially he's saying entropy can't exist at the macroscopic scale because we're dealing with phase space. So any function that acts on phase space, like your position or momentum or Hamiltonian or whatever you want, is not going to be able to have the properties of entropy. Well, Prigozhin found a way around this, and with someone called Misra, they published a paper. Entropy can exist. It just has to be more general functions than just operators on phase space or multiplications of these operators
right.
by phases. You have to consider functionals. And when they do this, they show, oh, okay, we can talk about microscopic entropy on phase space, but it requires us to have a complementary structure. And he means complementary in the same sense that Bohr talked about complementary between position and momentum, that there are conjugate observables that are complementary in nature. And he says, okay, if we include non-equilibrium entropy or macroscopic entropy into the phase space, what we recover is that there is going to be some non-commuting classical operators. And he derives a uncertainty relation between how a distribution on phase space evolves through the Liouville operator and this new time operator, which he calls the age of the system. And this age depends on the distribution, and it's connected to the Baker's map, and which the Baker's map is connected to the Stillard engine. And so there's like this line, this chain of ways to build up a very, very deep-rooted and rigorous, consistent theory for all of this stuff. And I'm just trying to fit all the pieces together. That's essentially what I'm doing.
Very interesting, man. I love it. So let's see what time we're at. We're at 56. But yeah, man, I guess we should probably start closing it out. But Did you have any final questions for Gabe to ask about it?
Yeah, because I'm just taking information, man. This is all like it's new and interesting to me. So yeah. It just like in the scope of all this, you're trying to build a theoretical framework for this. Because you were mentioning that you were trying to use, or you're trying to formalize it in a sense using operators in some sense, and then, but it's a huge task. But like,
sounds cool though, and I definitely think you understand it well to a point where you can actually explain it pretty nicely.
It's hard.
It definitely sounds a lot to understand.
It's a heavy, because it's like, especially if you're trying to build like the framework for it, the mathematically at least. I wouldn't even. That's I mean,
it
that's
sounds
sort
like
of
one of these hard.
Well, the thing is,
I
feel almost like it's not my place to do it, because all the work, from my point of view, it looks like it's already been done. I mean, I'm staring at this and saying, like, why hasn't anyone done this? I don't even have to do much. All the math has been there. It's been shown.
Yeah.
And it's just the connection or the application or just the intuition to use this particular framework or this methodology in a different context hasn't been done. And I'm sitting there like, this needs to be done. Needs to be formulated.
Yeah.
And so my focus at the moment is to just propose this and say, look, there is a more rigorous way that we can understand information, that it's going to highlight a lot of the physical principles of what information is and how it's tied to the physics that we're already familiar with, which is dynamic physics, quantum stuff, thermodynamics. And from what I understand, most of information at this point is done in a thermodynamic framework because of entropy, right?
Yeah.
But Pigozhing and colleagues in the School of Brussels and UT Austin, they're responsible for contributing a dynamical framework for entropy. Mm-hmm. And so what I see is an opportunity to have a dynamical description of information, not just a thermodynamic one. And so having that dualistic description, having both, understanding what information is in a statistical sense, in a probabilistic sense, in terms of thermodynamics, which is statistics, and then knowing what information is in a dynamical sense, which is deterministic, I think that is going to give us a full picture of the physical principles of what information is. Mm-hmm. And so this is where most of my effort is being put into, is nice. Kind of integrating these two.
I think that was a beautiful summation right there, or summary, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, I just want to say that, like, I mean, there have been moments like this in history, right, where, like, de Broglie or whatever, I'm butchering.
Right, where he literally, de Broglie, he literally just says, well, what if everything's a particle in a wave?
Yeah, he literally.
And he'd copy and paste the the vehicle's lambda.
But it's taking what's already what already exists in the literature and then synthesizing or connecting dots. I mean, a lot of the, like, Einstein.
And you see
Einstein,
and you're like, damn, why didn't I do that?
Yeah,
you
know? But it's like guys like Einstein, too, where they were looking at, like, there were theories of relativity at the time, but nothing cohesive.
Lorentz contributed greatly, and Minkowski, like, they.
Right, all these guys.
The work was there. I mean, Einstein was the one that really, really had the intuition. He really had the idea. Yeah.
Putting it all together.
And it's, funny thing is, all of this work that I've been doing is also related to gravity and Einstein's GR.
Mm.
In a very weird way, it is related to that, because what it does is it allows
us.
Yeah, that's working. I'm doing that with Mario. Yeah. We're working on doing this information theory and, like,
because if you're talking about
time, entropy, we're talking about. So what it does is essentially this work allows you to introduce a second time, not just the time parameter of evolution that we know in Hamiltonian and quantum mechanics, but a second time, a microscopic time, or just another time. And we get a transformation that is very similar to, like, a Lorentz transformation, but between two times, between two frames of time. A dynamic frame at the microscopic level and a probabilistic frame of time at the macroscopic level. And there's a transformation theory that allows us to go between one and the other at no loss of information.
Nice.
So it's just like in a Lorentz transformation. You can go from one frame to another and I was researching some of the equations of motion, the like hyperbolic boosts and things like that. They're very related to a lot of these weird transformations I've been doing in information theory with detailed balance and mass action kinetics or whatever. And so it's tied to gravity in some way. And of course you have black holes and information paradox and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So Mario and I are kind of working on that, but that's a lifelong work. That definitely is.
Cool, man. Do you think you might publish a paper or something independently on this at some point?
Absolutely. Okay. I think my goal now is to write up everything I've talked about in a way that I can present it to some of the professors I want to work with. Drzezinski being one of them. Mm-hmm. There's also another one. I think his name's Crutchfield. He's at UC Davis. And then anywhere at UT Austin, because Prigogine founded a school there. Mm-hmm. And then there is a guy named Parondo in Spain. So I have a list of professors that I want to send my work to see if they're interested in collaborating or just starting a discussion about what this work is, because I've done this all independently. So having someone that has experience and well-rooted intuition behind this work, I can imagine would be greatly beneficial and could point me in the right direction.
They can tell you if you're just like wasting your time.
Exactly.
And just like,
I mean, it could be such that when we start working, we'll have a paper in the first 3 years. It'll just be that quick.
Right.
So my goal is to just write it up and send it to them, and then who knows, see where it goes from there.
That's huge, man.
Beautiful, man. Well, I think that is a perfect end to the podcast. Gabe, thank you very much for coming out here, man.
Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, this is great. First time experience. I hope to be back at some point.
Yeah, of course,
more
of course.
More than likely, definitely. Because there's many more silly things that we can definitely talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's more of a rigorous podcast, but I'm sure that people can see that you are a guy with personality as well.
Yeah, there's a silly side to me that is not so...
But excellent, man. And guys, stay tuned for the outro.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, guys. Nice to see you again. Thanks for watching the podcast. I had a blast on this. Make sure you guys go to ikenbros.com and keep watching the podcast to have more conversations with me and people like me and learn a little bit about everything. It's great.
And don't forget to follow socials, Twitter, Instagram, all that shit. Go
follow it. And follow me in real life. I don't have any social media, but you can find where I live and stalk me for a bit. I'm accepting all fans.